Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, as we continue to pour through our big old monster box of baseball cards from the 1980s and a few from the 1990s as well. As we go year by year, set by set, we are in the increasingly overcrowded year of 1989. We've already brought in the new boys, Upper Deck and Bowman. And this time around, we're going to be looking at the sophomore edition of Score, which in my opinion was one of the worst baseball card sets ever produced, not just in 1989, not just in the 1980s, ever. It's right up there with 82 Fleer, although I think 82 Fleer still holds the title spot, if you will, of worst baseball card ever made. But 89 Score, definitely up there. Now, we'll talk a little bit about 89 Score. In fact, little is the key word there because there's not a whole lot to really get excited about. Our random pull, card number 637, Edgar Martinez. And when I say random, I mean one of maybe 8 cards from the Score set that I hung on to. I got rid of a lot of these cards a long time ago. But while the Score set in 1989 did not impress, Edgar Martinez certainly did. It was his sophomore year as well. Well, technically his junior year. He did already have a couple of partial seasons with the Mariners under his belt. But really, it would turn out 1989 would be the first kind of full season for Edgar at the major league level. He was starting to make his climb up from the minor leagues into becoming the designated hitter extraordinaire that everybody remembers him as. And, oh, by the way, I will already put out my feelings about Edgar Martinez and the Hall of Fame. Absolutely, he should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I know that's going to stir up the pot with some baseball purists, those of you that hate the designated hitter. And I'm not a fan of the DH. I prefer National League ball to American League ball. But I will give you a very good reason why Edgar Martinez should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. After we listen to your reasons why you absolutely hate 89 Bowman, I think a lot of you do. And this, of course, coming from our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We encourage you to share the account with a friend of yours. We always have very lively discussions about not only the podcast that we put out every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom, but also about just cards in general and some very, very interesting discussions going on here. So let's talk about the 89 Bowman set. If you listened to our last podcast, you heard me implore you to please give 89 Bowman, and for that fact, 90, 91, 92, those Bowman sets, a second chance. Because, as I said, really the one big knock about the 89 Bowman set is the big size. It was the 1953 Bowman size card, which measured 2.5 inches by 3¾ inches. And since baseball cards, really since 1955, have been 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches, this quite literally threw a curveball at collectors who suddenly had to buy new supplies or deal with damaged cards from this new set. And that's been hindering the popularity of the 89 Bowman set ever since. So that was pretty much what everybody was saying to me when I would put out these tweets that say, well, why don't you like the 89 Bowman set? Well, you let me know why. That's for sure. Ken Kinsley, I hated the size and still do to this day. It outweighs any possible positives. Supplies weren't made for these. And, you know, that was one of the big problems that I pointed out in the podcast, was that all of a sudden you had to buy the new pages, the plastic pages that held 8 cards and not 9. And the 8 cards were horizontal. So very few of the 89 Bowman cards were designed horizontally. They were vertical cards. They were basically tall boy cards. So you would put the cards in, but then, you know, all of your cards are basically on their side. It didn't look good. It was very inconvenient. And then, of course, top loaders didn't fit. You'd have to go buy specifically designed cardboard boxes. And because the Bowman cardboard box was bigger than the other boxes, they didn't stack up right. They didn't go into shelves correctly. Yeah, the industry did not welcome the 89 Bowman set, mostly because nobody wanted to go out and spend money on supplies. You wanted to spend money on the cards. And that was a very, very common theme. Ben Adams, I have a huge stack of bent-up cards from them being oversized. Yep, everybody does. Even the ones that ended up in the plastic pages, Ben, at least with my collection, still somehow got bent up. It's like they would slide out of those pages. I don't understand why. Jason Carter, 2 reasons why I don't like it. One, impossible to keep mint in binders because the top sticks out of a 9-pocket page. And of course, if you didn't want to go out and spend the money for an 8-pocket page, then that's what you were dealing with. Number two reason, according to Jason Carter, it began the onslaught of prospecting. How many of those rookies never played in Major League Baseball? And of course, I countered that the rated rookies from Donruss didn't necessarily pan out either. And if you listen to any of my previous Donruss podcasts, you know that with very few exceptions, you know, your Gary Sheffield and your Jose Canseco, I was not a big fan of the rated rookies set, because for every Gary Sheffield, there was Greg Olson. For every Jose Canseco, there was Hensley Mullins. I mean, there was always one drastic opposite bust in the rated rookies as opposed to the regular ones. Now, as for rated rookies, Jason disagrees with me. Rated rookies had about 30 cards, which was about 5% of the Donruss set. Bowman seemed to have more. Well, they certainly did have more, and that's actually what's kept the Bowman brand alive, Jason, is that they became, you know, it was an unofficial name. Bowman was the set for rookie cards, or the collection for rookie card collectors, and they made that official, I want to say late 90s, maybe 97, they actually branded Bowman as the rookie card set. So if you're somebody who really likes prospects, then the Bowman set is great, but if you're somebody who likes a little more immediacy, well, you have to buy Bowman cards and then wait 5 or 6 years to see who pans out, and you know, more often than not, it's guys that don't pan out, but the ones that do, you can actually make some pretty good money off of some of those cards. And just look no further than some of those early 90s sets where you had guys like Chipper Jones and Mike Piazza, Mariano Rivera, you know, years before they took off and got popular, but still some very, very valuable cards in those sets, or at least valuable compared to the rest of the set because of the overproduction. A lot of those card values, what should be a $25, $30, $35 card is now, you know, $6, $8, $10, somewhere along those lines. Now, Jason did continue with his thoughts. He said, other than the two reasons that he didn't like the set, he liked the facsimile autograph, the stat breakdown, and the simplicity of the design. Wish it was 2.5 by 3.5. Well, you did get your wishes granted in 1990. Clearly, the people at Topps, which owned the Bowman brand, looked at the whole set and went, oops, we need to scale this down to normal size. And the 90 set, which we'll talk about in a few podcasts, very similar to the 89 set, very simple, very minimalistic, with the same stats breakdown on the back. And, you know, I thought it was a hit then. And really, it was just the size problem that really caused fits for Tops and for collectors who had the Bowman cards. Scott H., Arizona baseball nut. I hated those when I was a kid. Had to get the special pages for them. There you go. You know, you've already sunk enough of your allowance into the cards. Now you got to get special pages and boxes for them. Let's see. Peter Steinberg, I'm with Jason on the back of the 1989 Bowman. Unique view of the player's previous season. And I'm a big fan of that as well. Really loved the way that the back of the card showed the splits. And again, I said Bowman was very far ahead in the race here in terms of advanced stats, you know, showing the splits of how a player performed against each and every team that he went up against. Now, you can't really do that nowadays because of Interleague. I mean, you would have to cram like 20 teams on the back of the cards. So that's something you're probably not going to see again. But I thought it was very unique, very ahead of its time, and certainly made Bowman stand out from the rest of the market. Now, I thought I had an ally in our friends at Baseball Card Backs, but no. Got to disagree about the Bowman backs. Found them uninteresting and pointless, except for one. And he brings up a tweet that was put up back in September. Remember Lenny Dykstra? He recently said that he had a pretty reliable drug source in Houston, and he had his best numbers against the Astros. And we see the back of the 91 Bowman Len Dykstra, card number 501. And you look at the numbers against the Astros, 12 games, 44 at-bats. Lenny Dykstra hit 523. So whatever they were growing in Houston, or points just a little southwest of there, apparently really helped nail the ball all these years. Then again, the 1990 Houston Astros were not a very good team. You could guess that they were probably drugged up on something, or incredibly just crappy, but definitely one of the two. So, you know, I fired back. I said, well, I'm stunned, you know, at baseball card backs for not backing me, not Lenny Dykstra on drugs, because, well, that's a given, isn't it? And baseball card back says, hey, I don't love all backs. I have standards. All right. Yeah. I've heard that before. I'm not a dancer. I'm saving money for school. All right. Arizona sports car collector. Still have hundreds of them. This set is why it was so easy for Upper Deck to take the market by storm. Good point there. And sometimes that's the difference in what creates a legendary set and a not-so-legendary set. And certainly in 1989, with Upper Deck raising the bar and having the higher quality card stock and the tamper-proof packaging and the counterfeit-proof cards and the really good rookie class and the big set too, you know, an 800-card set as opposed to Bowman having just over 400 cards in the set. Yeah, when you compare apples to apples, it's not even apples to apples. It's apples to kumquats. It was a completely different product being produced by Bowman in 1989 as opposed to Upper Deck. So an excellent point there. A few more comments here. Our buddy Robbie T, 86, in the time of score in Upper Deck, the card stock was garbage for a premium, quote-unquote premium product. Felt like a cheap undertaking. And again, you know, when you're looking at the Upper Deck cards and trying to compare them to Bowman, I mean, Upper Deck was far and away better than Bowman in terms of quality, despite some of the advances that I actually liked about the 89 Bowman set. One other thought here on the Bowman set, coming in from Gary Vassar. I like them. All right, we've got somebody on my side. I like them because it included Buddy Bell's last card in a Rangers uniform. So there you go. There's something bright to come out of the 89 Bowman set. And it's Buddy Bell's last card wearing a Texas Rangers uniform. All right, so we got it all out on the table. I am still a fan of 89 Bowman, despite the size, and I have said that the biggest knock on that set is the size. If it was a 2.5-inch by 3.5-inch card, I think more and more people would have liked it. And again, had it come out about 10 years later, had it come out in the late 90s, even with the old card stock and the plain look, I think it would have had a better launch. But because it was too big and because it was going up against a premium new set like Upper Deck and also some established sets and Topps and Fleer and Donruss, who did have good sets that year, and we'll talk about those a little later on here. In fact, we've got Donruss in our next podcast, followed by Fleer and Topps to round out 1989. Bowman didn't stand a chance then. The cards were overproduced, and now there's just a whole bunch of them still laying around now. But I again implore you, please, please give 89 Upper Deck another chance. The cards are so ridiculously cheap. Buy a few packs, go through them, look at the star selection, look at the stats on the back. You're not going to be able to store them anywhere because they don't fit in any of your supplies, but at least you can just put a rubber band around them and stack them up in your closet for all I care. But do give it another chance. Now, this is where I almost sound hypocritical. In fact, I might, because I'm telling you to take a look at 89 score just once. Don't give it a second chance. 89 score is an absolute train wreck. It is a total letdown, and for a number of reasons. One, because as opposed to 89 Bowman, which was new and was trying to do something different, 89 Score was the sophomore set for Score after a very good launch in 1988. As I mentioned in our 88 Score podcast, I thought Score did some things that Upper Deck would later get credit for doing, and that included better cardstock, sharp photography, bright cards, full-color photographs on the back of the litany of information, biographical, not statistics, but, you know, scouting report style reports on the back of these cards, very ahead of its time in 88 Score. And in 89, they tried to do the same thing with the backs. I think the backs of the cards are pretty good for 89 Score, but the front is just an absolute letdown. This, to me, 89 Score versus 88 Score, to me, is like 82 Fleer versus 81 Fleer. You know, the 81 set for Fleer, while not great, was a pretty good starting point, certainly better than Donruss in 1981, and then they just fell flat in 1982. But the good news is that Fleer would eventually pick themselves up in 1983 and produce some very good sets throughout the 80s. Same thing would happen with Score after fumbling here in 1989. They had a nice bounce back in 1990 and had some good sets moving forward, but 89 is just a mess. So let's take a look very briefly at the 89 scorecard, because I actually want to spend more time on Edgar Martinez and my case for him being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. 89 scorecard here. Now, there's one difference between this card and the others in the set, and that is the big 1989 rookie banner along the top. Of course, for the regular cards, the lower number cards, you didn't have that. The Edgar Martinez card was part of a subset within the main set of rookies that they were trying to put a little extra spotlight on, kind of like rated rookies or the Topps rookie trophy cards that you would see throughout the years. So you didn't have that on every card. You do have it on the Martinez card, and you actually have a decent picture of Edgar Martinez swinging through here, going through the follow-through. Almost either he's going to check his swing or he's about to wail on a fastball that's coming in on him. This is one of the few good photographs in the 89 Score set. In 88 Score, they had a great selection of photography. 89, not so much. Some of the pictures, the action shots, were actually pretty blurry. Like you could see, you know, Edgar's bat is a little bit of a blur here. A lot of the pictures, too, very dark, just not treated right. They seem to be in shadows. They're not colorized right. And what I mean by that is when they were developed, they're not jumping out at you. They're just kind of dark, kind of blurry, not as bright and energetic, I guess is the right word, as 88. So a real step down in the photography department in 1989. Now, again, 90, 91, 92, they would pick up in that department, but 89, such a letdown in the photography. And then in just the overall design, this is something that was just, in my opinion, slapped together. Like I said in the 82 Fleer podcast that we did months ago now, it just, somebody just went, all right, this will do. And they put it out there. It just didn't seem like to be a real concerted effort to build on the success of the 88 set to really make 89 stand out. So you've got the picture, which does take up about 85% of the front of the card, actually almost 90%, I'd guess. But then down at the bottom, you've got this baseball diamond kind of shadow effect here. You've got the player's team name, his position, and then his name along a blue border, although the color would change depending on the portion of the set. But, you know, a little border on the bottom, a lower third graphic almost, as we would say in television, with the player's name in this rather bizarre NASA-ish like font. It definitely screams 80s. This is the last vestige of the 1980s in the printing of a player's name on the front of the card. So what you get is this plain, often dark, you know, it's a card that doesn't pop. And, you know, we've used that term in previous podcasts, 88 Tops, for example. It just didn't jump out at you. You didn't go, ooh, wow. You know, it's just there. It's very average. And I think because it was such a step down from the 88 set, a lot of people don't like the 89 Score set. Also, much like the Bowman set, you're going up against a stellar Upper Deck product. You're going up against the legendary brands now, Topps, Fleer, and Donruss. Score's effort just did not match that. Now, some of the positives from the Score set, and I will give them some positives. The card stock, still A-plus card stock here. Again, a card stock that Topps had not switched to. In fact, they added Bowman to the mix. You would have more and more card companies, and you know, Fleer was already using a pretty good card stock. Donruss would come around a few years later, but the thicker white card stock was starting to become the mainstream by this time in the industry. And then the back of the card, the 89 Score tried to basically do the exact thing as 88 Score. And that's good and bad. Bad in the sense that it's really not that creative. Basically, the only change is they moved the picture of the player from the left side to the right side. And from the right side to the left side, the team logo, card number, and player personal information. And then, you know, the bottom half is pretty much the same. Now, the good thing about that is, you know, some of the aspects of the 88 set that I like, including that scouting style report along with these statistics, it's still there. So if there's something that redeems the 89 Score set, it's the back of the card, but you have to get past the front of the card and the really dreary pictures and just the lame, boring, plain layout it's not a good set. While I've told you before, sets like 89 Bowman or 88 Donruss, sets that get kicked around a lot by hobbyists, I'll tell you, you know what? If you have a few dollars to spend, go ahead and get some. I'll say that. 89 score, forget about it. Just don't even bother, because it's not only design, it's not only dark pictures, but it's also a lack of star power, including rookie cards. This was one of the sets in 1989 that did not have a Ken Griffey Jr. card. Now, he would come up in the score rookie and traded set later on in the season. Now, there are a couple of star rookie cards here. Craig Biggio, back then, of course, a catcher. A very famous picture of him, one of the few bright pictures, as it was a close-up mugshot of him holding a bat. And, you know, you had the bright Houston Astros uniform then, so that kind of made that picture stand out. Also, rookie cards for John Smoltz, Gary Sheffield, and Randy Johnson. So you've got some big names there, but because this set, like all the others in 1989, overproduced and a very underwhelming design, not a big rookie class, this is a set that a lot of collectors just bypass. And honestly, I don't blame you. I really don't blame you. Much like the Cal Ripken Jr. Card saves the 82 Fleer set, basically Craig Biggio, Edgar Martinez, John Smoltz, Gary Sheffield, those are really the only cards, and Randy Johnson, those are really the only cards that justify any kind of investment in the 660 card set in 1989. So there you go, my stellar review of the not so stellar 89 score set. Now, what is stellar is the career of the man who we pulled here, Edgar Martinez. As I've mentioned, a designated hitter extraordinaire, but an outstanding story with this guy. You know, with the Tampa Bay Lightning, that's the team that I work for in the National Hockey League, we have a couple of legendary players who were undrafted free agents. Marty St. Louis is the most famous one. Won a Stanley Cup with the team in 2004. He's going to get his jersey retired in this upcoming January. And then Tyler Johnson, who is currently with the team, had a very similar path, went undrafted, played junior hockey, became a star with Tampa Bay a few years ago, and hopefully we'll have a Stanley Cup championship for him. Well, Edgar Martinez is almost in the same boat there, as he was an undrafted free agent, signed with the Mariners in December of 1982, paid his dues in the minor leagues, would make his major league debut in September of 87, and then just went back and forth between AAA and the major leagues, started getting a few more games in 1989, and then finally became a full-time member in 1990. And he played third base, and he played it well. He was actually an all-star third baseman in 1992. In fact, you know, while some people knocked his defensive woes, he was not very good when he first got up there. He had 27 errors in 143 games in 1990. Well, the errors started coming down significantly. He had 15 in 91, 17 in 92. But then the unthinkable happened. He had a major injury in an exhibition game. That's just adding some, you know, salt to the wound right there. In 1993, the team was playing an exhibition game in Vancouver. In Vancouver, they played at BC Place Stadium, and they have artificial turf there. Of course, a lot of ballparks actually did back then, but there was a seam that was not completely lined up right, you know, between the patches of turf between first and second base. So he's running around, he tears his hamstring, and he was never able to fully recover, you know, 100% getting range of motion and muscle strength. So all of a sudden, his days as a third baseman are pretty much done. Now, even though defensively he was going to be a liability as a third baseman, still, he had a hell of a bat. The year before, he hit .343, led the major leagues in batting average, had 46 doubles that year. As I mentioned, he was an all-star, was also in the MVP running, a distant candidate. He finished 12th in voting, but just to be in the top 20 in the American League is something that you have to honor. So here's a guy whose career could be over, but thankfully for him and for the Seattle Mariners, that was not the case. Of course, Lou Piniella, the manager of the Mariners in 93, once Edgar was able to come back around to full health, he played much of the strike-shortened 94 season, but at the age of 32 in 1995, had 145 games, actually led the American League in games played, And he basically started his life over as a designated hitter, hit .356 that year, again, leading the American League, actually leading the major leagues, on-base percentage of .479, his OPS 1.107. Wow. And not only could he get on base, but he would make it all the way around. He led the major leagues in runs scored with 121 that year. And, of course, is best remembered by Seattle fans as the man who hit the game-winning double in 1995 in a playoff game against the New York Yankees, Game 5 of the Division Series. He hits a double off Jack McDowell. Mariners win the game 6-5. They win the series 3-2 for the first time in franchise history. Not only do they make an appearance in the playoffs, but they move on to the ALCS. They would lose to Cleveland that year. But that hit, that series of hits, not only advanced the Mariners that year, but they would start a pretty good stretch for the next several years of not only running away with the American League West, but also having some deep runs in the playoffs as well. The Mariners would lose out in the ALDS in 97, but they would have a couple of American League Championship Series appearances, 2000, 2001. There was a really good stretch of about 6-7 years under Lou Piniella that the Mariners had. And it started with 95 with that big Game 5 win in Seattle, the old King Dome, and with that Edgar Martinez hit. So in many ways, depending on who you ask, Edgar Martinez helped save the Mariners in Seattle. The Mariners were still teetering in the mid-90s, even though they were becoming a better team. But they were teetering a little bit financially. There was a whole lot of traction in building a new stadium. Well, once they started winning more consistently, 95, 96, 97, well, that finally pushed through a measure to get what is now Safeco Field built. And that is by far one of the best newer modern era ballparks in Major League Baseball. There's no doubt about it. So in many ways, Edgar saved baseball in Seattle, and he continued to contribute to the Mariners all the way up through the age of 41 as a designated hitter. And at the age of 41, he was still hitting .263. He was still playing in 141 games, still had 23 doubles, 63 RBI, scored 45 runs. I mean, this guy was still cranking away. But, of course, you know, those of us who are around the age of 40, your body starts acting a little differently. He started feeling that he was winding down. So at the end of the 2004 season, he called it quits and, got into business and is now a member of the Mariners coaching staff. He's been their hitting coach for the last couple of seasons. So Edgar Martinez, a guy who 35 years ago basically walked into the Mariners organization, played all of his career there, a very lengthy career, 2,055 games, and also contributes today to the community, to the Puerto Rican community as well in the Pacific Northwest because of his heritage, and to the team today too as a coach. So this is a guy who, like I said, was totally off the radar, is able to come up, work his way up into the Mariners organization, and he's had something to do with them, you know, like I said, really for almost 35 years in the organization, but with the team in Seattle since 1987. And that's just outstanding. And you can see why the biggest voices of people who want him in the Hall of Fame are coming from Seattle, because they've seen firsthand how good of a player he was, how good of a person he is, and how big of a factor he was for professional baseball to not only survive, but succeed in Seattle all these years. Now, I will state my case why he should be in the Hall of Fame, and that is quite simply because he really specialized in a position as designated hitter. It wasn't, you know, his choice. It kind of got thrust upon him, you know, after that injury in 1993. So he got put into a situation, and he certainly made the best of it. And the Mariners certainly used that to his advantage. And while he was a one-time All-Star as a third baseman, he was a six-time All-Star as a designated hitter. Of course, he would have to play third base or be a pinch hitter in the All-Star games that were in National League parks. And that happened a couple of times after he made that transition to DH. But here's a guy who excelled at his job. And again, I'm not a big fan of the DH rule. I know there have been rumors that the National League is thinking about going that way. I certainly hope they don't. One, because I prefer the National League way of ball compared to the AL way, even though I grew up a fan of American League teams, first the Blue Jays, now the Tampa Bay Rays. But I like the you know, there's a little more strategy that has to be used by managers. You know, if you pinch hit for that pitcher of yours, that changes the lineup. That changes the dynamic of who you've got coming in off your bench. That changes how you make pitching decisions. In the American League, it almost seems like it's just a parade of relief pitchers because there's no consequence to be paid in the lineup. You want to change a pitcher? Change a pitcher. Bring in a pitcher whenever you want. That's why Red Sox and Yankees games seem to take an eternity because you're just churning out pitching changes game after game after game, especially after September call-ups. Ugh. God, could those games be any longer? In the National League, there's a little bit of some strategy here because you have to factor in, okay, I'm shortening my bench by another person by having this pinch hitter. Okay, I'm changing my bullpen dynamic because I'm making a change now, you know, with the pitcher's spot coming up at the plate as opposed to just churning out bullpen after bullpen. And then, of course, there's the argument that the designated hitter in most situations, that's the one guy who is 41 years old who's still hanging on. Edgar was able to deliver when he was 41. Not every player is fortunate enough to do so. So, you know, there's the counter argument there. I also still like having the DH in the American League and not in the National League because I think nowadays that's the only thing that separates the two leagues. You know, you've had interleague for 20 years now. You've had, you know, parity between the leagues. I mean, any team can win the All-Star game now. Any team can win the World Series. Doesn't matter home field advantage. It doesn't matter DH versus non-DH rules. I think that's the only thing that keeps the two leagues apart. You take the DH out or you put the DH into the National League. I mean, you might as well just banish American League and National League. You might as well just have one big 30-team Major League Baseball league and that's it. Because I think that's the one thing that still separates the two. Now, as for why Edgar Martinez should be in the Hall of Fame, like I said, he specialized in that position. And I know what you purists are saying. I know what sports writers are thinking. Well, the designated hitter, that's a phony position. That's just created in the 70s to boost run production and make the American League a softball league and keep those 38, 39, 40-year-old guys playing. You know, it's just a ploy by the Players Association to keep somebody employed who really shouldn't be employed. And, you know, you get these snobby baseball writers, not all of them, but the ones who have a vote, you know, they think they're God because they have a vote to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And, you know, the guys who have made a living out of doing a niche job, writing about baseball, that's a niche job, are criticizing a guy who succeeded in a niche job, being a designated hitter. Again, not by choice, but because he tore his leg up in an exhibition game in Vancouver many years ago. And my biggest argument is, you know, other than picking on sports writers there, and I have quite a few friends who are those sports writers, but my biggest argument is we still put relief pitchers in the Hall of Fame. Am I right? Hoyt Wilhelm, of course, he was one of the first specialist pitchers. Of course, he wasn't elected until well after his career. But Raleigh Fingers, Bruce Sutter, Goose Gossage, all in the Hall of Fame. Dennis Eckersley, he's in the Hall of Fame not because he was a starter early in his career, but he was converted. He had the most success as a relief pitcher back in the 80s. And, you know, Mariano Rivera is going to be in there. Lee Smith will probably one day be there. Trevor Hoffman will likely one day be there. Troy Percival will likely one day be there. Now, those guys may be getting in there through the Veterans Committee because, like I said, you're going to be having some, you know, snotty baseball writers who say that they shouldn't be in there. But Edgar Martinez, you know, much like those guys specialized in coming in and pitching one or two innings, as the case may be, well, why can they get in the Hall of Fame if a guy who came up to bat three or four times in a game and did well in it couldn't be in the Hall of Fame? I just don't get it. You know, we will give the benefit of the doubt. And trust me on this, when Mariano Rivera gets inducted, he's going to end up with 90% of the ballot, minimum. He's probably going to get more because you're going to have all these New York writers and all these writers up in the Northeast who've been following him since day one, basically humping his leg and saying, this guy's got to be in the Hall of Fame. And you know what? Mariano Rivera absolutely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Don't get me wrong on that. But it's just amazing how a guy like Rivera, who you bring in for the ninth inning, who would pitch maybe 8, 9, 10 pitches, and that was it. That was his job. And he wouldn't come in until the next opportunity for him to pitch 8, 9, 10 pitches and dominate and close out a game. Well, Edgar Martinez, maybe he sees 8, 9, 10 pitches in a game. He has 3 or 4 at-bats in a game. He was very productive. I gave you the numbers, the on-base percentage, the batting average, the runs scored, never mind the RBI. If we can give love to pitchers who do a quote-unquote part-time job within the game that is key to the game, well, why can you not give an honor to the best quote-unquote part-time job in designated hitters to the best quote-unquote part-time player in Edgar Martinez as a designated hitter? Again, he's probably not going to get into the Hall of Fame until a Veterans Committee votes him in. I think at last count, he had like 43% of the vote, something like that. So he's still a very, very, very long way from getting into the Hall of Fame. But that's my argument. If we can give relief pitchers like Raleigh Fingers and Dennis Eckersley and, you know, soon Mariano Rivera, and like I said, you know, Troy Percival, Trevor Hoffman, you have to look at them. If you're going to give them a serious look and get them into the Hall of Fame, or as I mentioned, Fingers, Eckersley, you know, those guys are in the Hall of Fame, and Rivera will be. You know, those were guys who came in key situations. They had one role. They threw a few pitches. They rarely pitched more than one inning. That was their job. Well, guess what? Edgar Martinez came up to bat 3 or 4 times in a game. He tried to knock in runs. That was his job. Why can't that be in the Hall of Fame? If you're going to let relief pitchers, dedicated closers, go to the Hall of Fame, there is no reason why you shouldn't have a very good, dedicated, designated hitter. A 7-time All-Star, a 5-time Silver Slugger Award winner, 2-time AL batting champion, and the RBI leader in the American League for 1 year. There's no reason why you can't let this guy get into the Hall of Fame. That's my argument, and I'm sticking to it. Hopefully, we get to see that happen one day. And oh, by the way, speaking of Mariano Rivera, he has actually said that Edgar Martinez was one of the toughest outs that he had during his career. He did not like going up against Edgar Martinez. I know Pedro Martinez has said the same thing. There's a Hall of Famer right there. You know, Pedro says that, you know, Edgar was one of the tough guys to get out. Well, if you've got a Hall of Famer going, this guy was hard to get out. You know what? Maybe that merits a little discussion. Hey, this guy wasn't just a designated hitter. He was a hell of a hitter. And I think if you look at that position, at the circumstances that brought him into it, you know, an injury, this guy's career could have been done 5-6 years. He could have disappeared in the mid-90s. Instead, he was able to be reinvented into a designated hitter and a damn effective one. He absolutely should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to be soon. Like I said, it's probably going to be one of those situations where it's a Veterans Committee that votes him in many, many years from now. But Edgar Martinez, who has been in every other Hall of Fame on the face of the planet, including the Seattle Mariners Hall of Fame. Duh, that was an easy one. This guy, to me, it's a no-brainer. He's got to be there. He's got to be there. And hopefully we get to see the day that he does get to be inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I think people take a second look at the designated hitter. A lot of them are veteran guys hanging around for a little while. But Edgar Martinez was not a veteran guy. He was 31 years old when he started doing it. And he delivered time and time and time again for 10 years in that position. Not too many veteran guys hanging around are able to do that. Edgar was able to make a specialty of it. And oh, by the way, he was a pretty good third baseman before he tore up his leg in that exhibition game. So there you go. Edgar Martinez, card number 637 of the 89 score set, and our random pull, one of the few bright spots of the 89 score set in our podcast of it, because like I said, I absolutely do not like this set. Love the player. Big props to Edgar Martinez and everything he did in his career and for the city of Seattle and for the Mariners. You know, Seattle may not have the Mariners. I live in Tampa. I know we tried to lure the Mariners here back in the early 90s. Didn't happen. Nintendo bought them, sold them for a pretty good fortune not too long ago. So Edgar, even though he's pictured on a less than flattering card from a less than flattering set, he was certainly a flattering baseball player, and respect him very much to this day, and I hope he does get that call to Cooperstown sooner than later. All right, your thoughts about Edgar Martinez, my call for him to get inducted into the Hall of Fame, the 89 score set, or anything else about the hobby, jump on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Let us know what you think. Also, Don't forget to tell your friends about our podcast, which comes out every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom. We'll have another one coming your way on Tuesday, where we move on to the 89 Donruss set, a set that doesn't get kicked around as much as 88 Donruss, but there's some pros and cons to it. Overall, I think it's a good set. But it's one of those sets that, because there was just so many coming out in 1989, often gets overlooked. So we'll do a random pull for the 89 Upper Deck set and talk a little bit about one of those sets that does kind of get overlooked from a very overproduced era in baseball card history. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much again for listening to Wax Ecstatic, and we'll see you next time.